Welcome to Current State from WKAR News, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We start with more investigations into how Michigan State University handled sexual abuse complaints against physician Larry Nassar. USA Today reported Friday that he is now being housed at the Milan Federal Correctional Institution, where he is serving 60 years in prison for federal child pornography charges. Nassar was also sentenced in Eaton and Ingham counties for several decades in prison for abusing girls and women. Joining me now is Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta with insight on how the investigations are going. Welcome to Current State, Rick.
Hi, Reginald.
What's the latest from Attorney General Bill Schuette's office?
Michigan State University President John Engler has said that the Attorney General will get the rest of the documents and information and communications that that office has been looking for related to the Larry Nassar investigation. You might remember that the investigating team has already executed a search warrant at the university, and actually President Engler was none too pleased that this was made public and that there were news media and TV cameras present, and strongly suggested that that should not happen again.
There are also inquiries coming from state lawmakers. What's the status of those?
Actually, exactly the same, that they have requested communications related to any complaints that may have been made regarding Larry Nassar, and the university says that those deadlines will be met as well. And, you know, let's not forget that there are congressional investigations in the works. The U.S. Department of Education is looking into MSU's handling of these complaints. There's an NCAA investigation. We will likely see an FBI investigation before it's all over as well.
There is a third congressional committee that's looking into the Nassar case.
Yes, that, members of Michigan's congressional delegation have called for investigations. I know that the Commerce Committee is engaged on this, and now we've heard that the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee will look into MSU, the U.S. Olympic Committee, USA Gymnastics, and the Twistars Gymnastics Club in Diamonddale. And those hearings, I mean, any congressional hearing is serious, but I've attended these hearings, going back to the Flint water crisis, and they can be pretty intense.
How is the administration and President Engler responding to these inquiries? You kind of gave a little hint of that a little earlier.
Well, they say they're going to meet all the deadlines, and this is actually very important, but President Engler sent a memo to MSU employees cautioning them against destroying anything that might be used as evidence, and that might seem kind of an intuitive thing to do, but it's important that the leader of the organization make clear that that is an expectation, which is what he did.
Well, thank you for joining us. Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta, keeping on top of all the investigations into MSU's role into the Larry Nassar abuse allegations and so much more there at the Capitol.
Thanks for asking me to join you, Reginald.
On Tuesday, the Michigan State University Faculty Senate will hold a vote of no confidence in MSU's Board of Trustees. If the Faculty Senate votes no confidence, it will call for all members of the Board of Trustees at MSU to resign immediately. Last week, the faculty joined students in a march across campus to express their displeasure with both the trustees and Interim President Engler. WKAR's Kevin Lavery was there.
This stops now! This stops now!
Chris Thalen never thought she'd be a soldier in the Battle of Michigan State University. But on Tuesday morning, there she was, among the dozens of protesters who had marched to the Hanna Building to call out the university's leadership. The College of Education grad student admits finding her voice in the midst of the ongoing sexual assault scandal at MSU has been scary.
Honestly, I've said and done things in terms of being a leader in the last couple of weeks that I've never done in my life.
Thalen's is a sentiment that's likely shared by many students and faculty members who have found themselves energized against a sense of injustice. When the Board of Trustees announced former Governor John Engler as its choice for interim president 1 week ago, many were quick to criticize the board for making its decision without consulting the campus community. Graduate student David Bowers had not planned on speaking up at the rally, Standing at the foot of the stairs, he apologized for his ineloquence. The crowd didn't seem to mind. Speaking directly to reporters, Bowers spoke of the media's tendency to title Engler as an ex-Republican governor.
That's true, but irrelevant, and it dilutes the message. This is not a partisan issue. It has nothing to do with that. Someone who decided to block investigators from looking into the rape and assault of people in prison does not belong in charge of it.
Bowers was referring to Engler's 1998 decision to decline a meeting between state officials and a United Nations representative. The UN had wanted to come to Michigan to study reports of violence against female prison inmates. Then Governor Engler believed the visit was motivated by a federal lawsuit that alleged Michigan had violated the inmates' constitutional rights. Engler dismissed the allegations as having no merit, and he called the Justice Department's lawsuit baseless. Now, 20 years later, the MSU College of Education had its own letter to give to John Engler. Reading the text aloud, Associate Professor Tara Chambers said Engler's selection suggests the university, quote, has chosen a protectionist rather than a reformation stance. Then came the bottom line. Do it over.
MSU student government, faculty senate, and the remaining MSU administration must work collaboratively to create a process for appointing an interim president. As this was not done with Engler's appointment, he should now resign in order for a more collaborative process to take place.
But even if Engler's resignation comes to pass, a list of potential candidates has yet to surface publicly. In the short term, though, MSU students are looking for a change on a more fundamental level. For her part, junior Laura Mortensen wants to see a clearer process for reporting sexual assault.
Fortunately, nothing ever has happened to me while I was on campus, but if it did, I don't really know what I would do, honestly. Like, I mean, what do you do if something happens? Who can you trust?
Before the rally was over, some in the crowd pledged to stage more protests each week until the Board of Trustees acts on the demands that have been handed them by students and faculty. The board's next official public meeting is scheduled for Friday, February 16th. But by then, its eight members will likely face a harsh reality. An overwhelming 86% of faculty who recently took part in an electronic ballot authorized the MSU Faculty Senate to initiate a vote of no confidence in the Board of Trustees. The Faculty Senate is expected to do so at its upcoming meeting on Tuesday. A statement calling for the resignation of the entire board is all but guaranteed to follow. For WKAR, I'm Kevin Lavery.
With so many MSU students saying they'd like to have a voice in picking a new leader, we decided to ask students what they want to see in the future. Here is the point of view of three students.
My name is Joshua Jarvis. I am a finance and econ major at MSU. I am a sophomore, and I am the treasurer of Zeta Beta Tau fraternity. So what I would like to see from our leadership is we need more emphasis on actually controlling sexual assault. And obviously you can't control all sexual assault. That's just how it is. But I see like in East Lansing, like in the actual city, they have like people on horses and this, that, and the other, actually just watching people on the streets, not necessarily just for being too intoxicated and stumbling and falling or whatnot, but also just looking over people. And when you have a group of girls walking from a party to their house or house to a party or wherever, they're looking over them, so like guys aren't coming up and sexually assaulting them out of nowhere or this, that, and the other. And I feel like we should have some type of emphasis on that on campus.
My name's Caitlin Scalzi. I'm a junior, and I'm also a media and information major. I am part of Run Club and the Royal Theater's player group on campus. I would like to see with the MSU leadership, probably just more like people taking responsibility, because there's been a lot of like fingers pointing and saying, oh, I didn't know this happened. Oh, they knew it was happening. Oh, no, they didn't know it was happening. And it's like, we have to stop playing these games and just really focus on the important people, which are the survivors and the rest of the students. Like, some people are feeling totally unsafe now, like on campus. Like, I feel like I can't go to the MSU police or I can't go to Meridian police because it will just get brushed under the rug. And it feels like the Board of Trustees also isn't hearing like our demands or they're not hearing our comments. They're kind of just saying, oh, well, this is like an issue. How can we get past this the quickest way so we can get more students into the university and make more money?
I'm Sean Goulet. I'm majoring in animal science, so pre-veterinary course. I am a junior here at Michigan State. I am heavily involved in Royal Players. I am also involved with the Pre-Veterinary Medical Association on campus. And I am, from time to time, involved with some of the LGBT Resource Center events. I like to see administration that's more trusting in their students and that is more protective too, going with the being more active, so trying to create more preventative measures for these events and training faculty to know how to respond to these events when someone comes and reports these cases to them, so that way they can create a more safe environment for students to be at, whether they're here for academics or they're involved with a lot of sports or whatever activity it may be, that they have a safe outlook for them.
Our thanks to Joshua Jarvis, Caitlin Skelsey, and Sean Goulet for giving their opinions on what they'd like to see in future MSU leadership. And if you want to share your opinion and you're a Spartan, email me at rhardwick@wkar.org. That's rhardwick@wkar.org. Still ahead on Current State, meet the two men vowing to help lead Lansing schools into the future.
I want to be an advocate for those kids.
Attracting and holding students in the district has been a very serious challenge that's affected Lansing.
A veteran Michigan journalist explains why not knowing all of American history may hurt all of us.
I don't know a single black person who is blaming a single white person living today for slavery. But I know that as long as you've got people who are white or who are any color who want to continue to pretend like it didn't happen, they are hurting our moving forward.
And with the start of the Winter Olympics, some insights on Korean culture from a Michigan State University student.
I hope after you guys watch the Olympics, try to talk with more Korean people.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR News. You are listening to Current State from WKAR News. Two vacancies on the Lansing School District's Board of Education were filled this week. WKAR's Scott Pohl introduces us to the district's newest board members.
The Lansing Board of Education lost two members in recent weeks. Peter Spadafore resigned following his election to the Lansing City Council, and Shirley Rogers passed away. The school board took applications for the openings and interviewed candidates on January 25th.
I'm Dr. Nathan Burrows. I'm an education policy researcher in the School of Education here at Michigan State University.
My name is Farhan Bhatti. I am a physician here in Lansing.
Dr. Bhatti is CEO of Carefree Medical, which he describes as a safety net clinic, second only in size in Ingham County to the County Health Department. He says he's had an interest in education for a long time.
As a family physician, I take care of children, and I see kids from day one of life all the way through, you know, adults all the way through end of life, and I sort of have a front row seat to some of the challenges that our kids are facing. And I think that's what really motivates me. What really motivates me is that most of the young people that I care for at Carefree attend the Lansing School District. And so I'm able to chat with them about, you know, the challenges that they have and you know, talk to them about their hopes and their dreams and you know, what they need to overcome to be able to achieve them. I want to be an advocate for those kids.
As an education researcher at MSU, Nathan Burrows has studied Lansing schools and calls himself a reasonably informed observer of the district. He says he's been involved in public life for many years.
Like a lot of people, after the 2016 election, I was looking for new ways to get involved. And I spent much of 2017 trying to find the right way to do that. And then when I read that there were two vacancies on the school board, I had a flash of insight that this was something I really needed to do.
The focus of Burroughs' research has been educational inequality and curricular inequality. One of the challenges he's observed in Lansing is the downward trend of enrollment in the district.
Lansing School District, like a lot of large urban school districts, has experienced fairly persistent enrollment decline with people moving out of the district or sending their children to schools outside of the Lansing School District or to charter schools. So attracting and holding students in the district has been a very serious challenge that's affected Lansing, like other districts like Flint or Detroit.
Bhatti has been involved in politics for some time, including work on then-Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero's unsuccessful campaign for governor in 2010. He says politics and public service are in his blood. Bhatti is encouraged by new mayor Andy Shore's interest in working with the school district, an interest signaled by Shore's choice of the Patton Gill Academy for his first State of the City address this week.
Well, I think Mayor Shore has a strong commitment to education. Both of his kids attend the Lansing schools. I had the opportunity to work with Mayor Shore as part of his campaign. I'm proud of the fact that Mayor Shore has prioritized having a good relationship with the school district.
Speaking of having kids in Lansing schools, neither Bhatti nor Burroughs has any children. For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
Blackness. Keep on.
February is Black History Month. Harvard-trained historian Carter G. Woodson began a campaign 103 years ago to recognize the achievements of African Americans in U.S. history. This year, Rochelle Riley, a longtime columnist for the Detroit Free Press, is sharing experiences and emotions on race relations in a new book called The Burden: African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery. She promoted the book last week at Michigan State University, and afterwards she and I talked a little bit about her book and what the burden means to both Black and white Americans.
Well, this started years ago with me carrying the burden of curiosity and frustration at not knowing my family and realizing that, you know, we never deal with slavery in this country. And until we do, and I don't mean just a conversation about reparations. I didn't ask anybody for a check. What I want is an acknowledgement that it happened, an acknowledgement that we still suffer from the vestiges of it, and an effort to do something about that.
Earlier tonight in your talk, you talked about, for example, families and being broken up, and yet there was a lot of criticism of the Black family.
It grates on my nerves when people talk about the dysfunctional Black family and how Black parents don't take care of their kids, which of course isn't true. It's no truer than saying all white families are the parents of school shooters. I mean, that's ridiculous. But I think that, you know, you're talking about centuries of people tearing families apart, wives away from husbands, children away from their parents, and sold to different plantations where they weren't allowed to be taught to read, weren't allowed to know what had happened, and weren't allowed to excel or to accept any type of greatness. And now, when you have certain problems, a lot of them caused by poverty, with the Black family, there's nothing worse for me than racists saying, oh, you know, you need to fix the Black family. Well, you broke it. You broke it, help fix it. And the bottom line is, until we stop pretending like slavery didn't exist or hoping we can sleep our way through it, and, well, if we don't talk about it, then maybe they'll forget that it happened. We're never going to forget. I'm never going to stop talking about it.
What is the burden that African Americans carry?
There are so many. The burden of not being able to be your best self, the burden of having to have asked for permission for everything for all of the 150-something years that African Americans have been free, permission to literally speak, permission to vote, permission to attend equal schools, permission to ride on buses that your tax dollars paid for, permission to sit at lunch counters in public places, permission to live in some cases. We went from lynching at the turn of the last century to police shootings at the turn of this century. We're always asking for permission to be free and permission to be happy. We shouldn't have to ask for permission. That's the biggest burden. And then there's also this idea that we shouldn't have our stories, not tell our stories. People who get offended because we write about Black people. As a columnist, every time I write about something that has to do more with African Americans than others, or celebrating African Americans. I get people saying, God, why are you doing that? That's like playing the race card. I said, number one, you're misusing the metaphor. And number two, that's not what it is. I'm black. Why do you not want me to celebrate what happens? What you should be doing is asking, why is it the 21st century and there are still certain things that black people are doing for the first time? I will not stop celebrating. I will not stop celebrating our greatness as long as it took for us to burst out and be great, and I will not stop writing about our history, because if I do, I will be helping to contribute to us losing our story, and I'm not going to let that happen.
So that today, I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves.
You talked about how former First Lady Michelle Obama at the Democratic National Convention last year talked about the White House being built by slaves and how people took offense to that. How is that a burden and part of the story that you're telling?
We got to carry around that suitcase of history and pull stuff out every now and again to remind people. And how dare we have to do that? I mean, really, who do they think built these buildings in Washington? Seriously? The idea that we have to actually have somebody go and study history to know that she was telling the truth. As I said, there was this collective gasp across America. Slaves built the White House? Well, of course. You didn't do it. Your ancestors didn't do it. Come on, really? I think that the idea that we have to constantly remind people that we've done things, constantly remind people that we built this country, constantly remind people that we were not a burden. The burden is us having to constantly remind you that we were there helping to build it along with everyone else. That's a burden we ought to be able to put down. And if we taught all children all history, we wouldn't have to work so hard.
What's the burden for white Americans?
For some of them, it is literally knowing that this is true, knowing that this is right. I don't know a single black person who is blaming a single white person living today for slavery. But I know that as long as you've got people who are white or who are any color who want to continue to pretend like it didn't happen, they are hurting our moving forward. And there's that burden that they carry. So put that burden down. Let's all put all our burdens down, deal with it, and then we can move forward.
Who should read this book?
Everybody. Every single person. I know there are some young people who have already told me they want to read it. I hope that you're either very precocious or over 11, because all of these 24 essays are very deep, very powerful, some very searing, and it's very, very serious. And I think that there ought to be a copy in every library, there ought to be a copy in every high school, there ought to be a copy in every sorority house. And I want everybody to start having this conversation so we can finally, finally, finally talk about who we are as America. And a big part of that is slavery and what it did. And we're not going to pretend like it didn't happen. We'll just embrace it and try to move on from it together.
Thank you, Rochelle, for joining me, and thank you for coming to MSU to talk about your new book.
Thank you so much. I'm a Tar Heel, but when I'm not, go Spartans.
I love hearing that Olympic music. This is the opening weekend of the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, and over the next few weeks, we're likely to see insight into Korean culture. Here in the Capital Region, the Korea Student Organization at Michigan State University is dedicated to helping people understand Korean culture. And student Chan Ho Lee joins me in studio right now. Welcome to Current State.
Hi, nice to meet you.
And tell me a little bit about yourself. You were born in South Korea, grew up in the U.S. What are you studying?
So I'm studying mechanical engineering, and I grew up half of my middle school in Michigan, and I grew up rest of my high school from Vegas, which is totally opposite place, but I really like the MSU. So
let me ask you, are you excited to see the Olympics in South Korea?
Of course, because it's been a really long time that Olympics are happening again. So I'm really excited, and I'm very, most likely, I really love to see especially ice skating, because I usually played ice skating when I was young. So I'm very excited right now.
Okay, let's talk about the opening ceremony when we see a lot of the art and music of the host country on display. We're going to ask about a few of the performers from South Korea, starting with Ha Yoon-woo. Who is he?
So, okay, Ha Jung-woo is a rock star, one of the most famous rock stars. He sings really good.
Bye.
I understand Insuni will perform. Her story is interesting to a lot of Americans because she is half Korean and half African American. Her father was a U.S. service member. So why does her voice kind of stand out?
Because since she had a, when she was young, she also had racism when she was young. And she overcome that and she became a really popular singer. And I think the Korean government tried to show that by her singing a song, which is representing Korea culture, people can understand that she could overcome the difficulties when she was young, and now she's become a really famous singer, so she can give more hope and power to the people.
Let's listen to a little bit of Insuni sing the official song of this year's games, Let Everyone Shine. Let everyone shine, let everyone shine and shine. 이 세상 그 어디든 밝게 비추리. Let everyone shine, let everyone shine and shine. We're talking with MSU student Chan Ho Lee, a member of the MSU Korea Student Organization, about the display of Korean culture during the Winter Olympics. Away from the opening ceremony, tell us about some of the traditional clothing we will see.
Probably it's called a hanbok, which is Korean traditional clothes. I think a lot of girls or the women will like it a lot because it's very colorful and it's very beautiful.
The hanbok is the traditional attire of the Korean people. The clothing is very colorful and elegant. The jacket should be tight and fitted while the skirt is relaxed.
So it's not normal clothes that you wear every day, but we wear that by specific days like Thanksgiving in Korea, which is a little bit different than the U.S. Thanksgiving. But we wear that during the Thanksgiving, and also we wear that when there's a marriage. So we wear that only the special days, but some people wear that for every day. So I don't think that is a bad thing, but I'm pretty sure you guys will have a lot of interest with that hanbok traditional clothes. I'm hoping to see that a lot of people can understand more about Korean culture, and I hope a lot of people don't think about that Korea is, war is not happening, so Korea is a really safe place. I hope when people heard about Korea, they don't think Samsung. I hope they would think more about the Korean culture more than the technology.
Anything else you're hoping people kind of get out of the Olympics or their experience of seeing all this Korean culture in front of them?
I guess don't be shocked. Just enjoy it. Just watch it like you guys watching a Super Bowl. So it's one of the sports, so don't get mad. Just enjoy it.
Okay. And you'll be watching the figure skating, right?
Of course. Of course.
Well, thank you for joining me, MSU student Chan Ho Lee, who is a member of the Korean Student Association, and we've been talking about Korean culture on display during the Winter Olympic Games.
Thank you.
Just ahead on Current State, a local county springs into action after an outbreak of hepatitis A.
Illness typically presents about 15 to 50 days after.
A promise of positivity from the new mayor of Lansing.
So I've said it before, and you're going to hear it again and again. Lansing's time is now.
And we head up north as Black Lake sturgeon fishing season starts. Learn how a change of rules may protect this prehistoric fish. You're listening to Current State from WKAR News, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
Being a Capital reporter doesn't mean I spend every day in Lansing. In fact, I've had to travel all around Michigan to cover the state's politics, and that's meant I've had to record in some uncomfortable places. Under a table at a Grand Rapids convention, in a car with the windows rolled up in the middle of August, in a cubby near a bathroom at a rally in Detroit. I'm Shayna Roth. Tune into WKAR and get your political news from people who are willing to work from anywhere.
This is WKAR Morning Edition host Brooke Allen. I'm a mom, a Michigan native, and a morning person. Whether you live in Albion or Ann Arbor, Detroit or DeWitt, Jackson or St. John's, Lansing or Lanesburg, our goal is to wake you up with fresh, fact-based journalism and features that will make you the most informed at the office or school. Join me for Morning Edition with Brooke Allen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 a.m. here on 90.5 FM WKAR, your NPR station.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR News, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Health workers are adding hours to vaccination clinics in Eaton County after an outbreak of hepatitis A. WKAR Morning Edition host Brooke Allen has more on the illness, the outbreak, and what's being done about it.
We are discussing the hepatitis A outbreak in Eaton County. Abigail Lynch is the public information officer for the Barry Eaton District Health Department. She's with us here in the studio. And so four cases have been diagnosed of hepatitis A, and there's actually been one fatality. So Abigail, tell us, who's at risk for hepatitis A?
So in this outbreak, anybody can get hepatitis A. I'll start with saying that. In this outbreak, certainly at higher risk are people who use illegal drugs, people who are homeless or in transient housing, and people who are or have recently been incarcerated. And men who have sex with men are also at a higher, appear to be at a higher risk.
And the symptoms, you mentioned them briefly in our first break, but go ahead and tell me what those are again.
Sure. The symptoms are nausea, vomiting, stomach pain, fatigue, joint pain, fever. And then jaundice, which is a yellowing of the skin and eyes, pale stool, and dark urine can also be symptoms.
And then there is an incubation period?
Illness typically presents about 15 to 50 days after exposure, so anywhere in that time frame.
Okay. And because of this outbreak, there's a vaccination clinic going on, correct?
Yes. So at our clinic in Eaton County, we are offering walk-in hepatitis A vaccines from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And then on Wednesdays, we're also extending our hours till 7 p.m. So anybody who wants to get a hepatitis A vaccine can walk in and we'll get that to them.
Okay. So tell me about the cost associated with this.
Sure. Most insurance does cover the hepatitis A vaccine. Our health department doesn't accept all insurances. So if you do have insurance, we recommend that you first contact your primary care provider or local pharmacy. For those people who don't have insurance or whose insurance doesn't cover the vaccine, if they're in a high-risk group, one of the groups I mentioned earlier, or there's a few other people who are at elevated risk, then they may be eligible for a low-cost vaccine. Otherwise, the cost of the vaccine is $71 per dose.
Okay, and so actually, where's the health department located?
So our address is 1033 Healthcare Drive in Charlotte.
Okay, so you said people can just walk in and this vaccination is available.
Yes.
Okay, no appointment necessary.
No appointment.
Okay, and so some of those, the people that are high risk for hepatitis A, are there any questions asked? I mean, is there a stigma associated to this?
Well, when people have hepatitis A, we do case investigation work with them as part of our health department epidemiology to try to find out what risk factors they have, where they might have gotten the disease, and what close contacts they may have who need to be treated. But like I said, anybody can get hepatitis A. It's not just people in these high-risk groups. So just because somebody has it doesn't mean that they're engaging in any of these high-risk activities.
So they don't need to be embarrassed?
No.
Okay, because people will be embarrassed.
Sure, yeah, no, there's no need for embarrassment, and certainly there probably is a stigma attached with it, but we can't help when we get sick.
Correct, so you really have to, if you're experiencing any of those symptoms, you really have to just forget about the stigma or what you're thinking, and you just have to take care of yourself and really take care of your health, because this is contagious.
Absolutely. If you have any of these symptoms or if you think you may have been exposed to somebody with the disease, contact your healthcare provider, and they can walk you through whether they recommend that you get tested, and if you need treatment, if you need to go to the hospital, they'll help you out.
Thank you, Abigail, for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR News. Now let's talk about some new beginnings for Lansing and Ingham County. Less than 40 days into his new job, Lansing Mayor Andy Shore delivered an upbeat message in his first State of the City address last Wednesday. WKAR's Kevin Lavery was there.
Maybe it was nervous anticipation, or perhaps it was the unrestrained enthusiasm of a new mayor anxious to give his first major public address since his New Year's Day inauguration. Or it might have simply just been a logistical glitch. Whatever it was, Andy Shore was early. The Lansing mayor's very first State of the City address was supposed to begin at 7 p.m. to catch a live web stream. Shore took the podium well before then and tried to brush off the awkwardness of the situation.
Thank you, everyone. I'm going to stall a little bit because, believe it or not, we are a little early and we're supposed to be waiting for TV.
Shore spoke at Patton Gill Academy, the glittering 175,000-square-foot showpiece of the Lansing School District. With the school board and city council members by his side, Shore spoke of the importance of collaboration among the two entities.
The future of the city of Lansing is directly connected to the excellence of our schools. In order to have a successful city, we must partner with the Lansing School District in order to grow and be prosperous. As a father whose children are students in the Lansing School District, and as someone passionate about Lansing, this is very personal to me.
The mayor outlined a litany of new initiatives he plans to launch in the coming months. He said Lansing will revitalize its downtown riverfront with a $1 million matching grant program from the Capital Region Community Foundation. Shore announced the creation of a Blue Ribbon Commission to advance arts and cultural programming. And he recognized Mark Lawrence, the city's newly minted citizen advocate. Lawrence will be the go-to guy tasked with ensuring Lansing residents get swift and complete answers to their concerns. A key moment of the address came as Shore announced a program to boost small business. Through the crowd lending platform Kiva, Fund Lansing will help local entrepreneurs secure loans they can't otherwise get through traditional lending sources.
More people in the region will have access to zero-interest loans of up to $10,000 to achieve their dreams of owning their own business. With LEAP's help, the City of Lansing will take Fund Lansing a step further to provide additional support to Lansing-based entrepreneurs.
For qualifying businesses, the mayor promised the city will match Kiva's loan funding dollar for dollar. The city's financial health has long been a drumbeat for those who point to its monetary obligations to its retirees. Mayor Shore said he's rebooting the Lansing Financial Health Team, the group formed under his predecessor, Virge Bernero.
The city of Lansing faces $680 million in future unfunded pension and health care costs, according to the latest report. Now, while this bill doesn't come due for a number of years, we need solutions now. While this won't be easy, it will take partnerships, vision, and innovation to address these challenges. We want to take care of those that have helped the city in the past, but we also must ensure we can help the city in the future.
There were other previews of things to come. Shore said the city will prioritize road repairs this spring and post online a list of roads that have been fixed as well as the costs. There were a few somber notes as well. While violent crime has fallen by 13% in Lansing over the last 2 years, Shore noted the city has logged 20 heroin overdoses and 4 opioid-related fatalities since the start of this year. Sporting a teal ribbon on his lapel, Mayor Shore paused to address the local sexual assault crisis that has captivated the country.
We must recognize that the last few weeks and months here have been a trying time for our region and have shed light on the potential for evil that we could all face. And we haven't experienced this in a vacuum. It's been felt and witnessed throughout the nation and the world. My heart goes out to the victims of the heinous crimes perpetrated by Larry Nassar, some of whom I know personally, and we must be ever vigilant to not anything like that ever happen again.
Mayor Andy Shore concluded his first State of the City address by remarking that Lansing is, in his words, in a good place, and that his team has plans, quote, to do so much more.
So I've said it before, and you're going to hear it again and again. Lansing's time is now. Thank you, everyone.
For WKAR News, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Also, the Ingham County Board of Commissioners appointed Dennis Lowney to represent the county's 10th district on Lansing's east side. The vacancy had been created by the resignation of Brian McCrane, who now runs the Economic Development and Planning Department in the city of Lansing. Lowney tells WKAR Scott Pohl that when it comes to listening to his constituents, McCrane has been a role model.
He's a friend that I got to know. I did not know Brian before he got on the commission, but I got to know him because of his ability to work within the community, to work with people, and to listen. And I think that was a good role model for me in now assuming this position, that it's so important to do that. I learned that in my position on the Board of Water and Light. I learned that in working with people. But Brian really did that. He was there when people needed something. He may not have agreed with them. And to me, that's the ultimate job of anyone who's in positions like this, that you're there to help represent people. You're there to listen to them, but you're also there to make them aware and educate them as to how can you engage them in government and really make sure that they're respected and their opinions are respected. And Brian did a great job with that.
As the newest member of the Board of Commissioners, what do you see as the biggest challenges currently facing Ingham County?
You know, I think the biggest issue coming up will be the whole idea of a justice complex and what we have to do to upgrade the court system, the issues with the jail. The jail at Ingham County is having lots of problems, just physically deteriorating. And when we look across Ingham County, infrastructure is really important. So one of my goals in the long run is to look at making sure we have a strong asset management program and that we can implement that and prioritize our infrastructure so we don't have failings like they did in Flint, or we don't have a jail that's falling apart and we can't house prisoners, or that provide a threat in a courtroom to someone who might be there testifying. So to me, that's number one. And I think from there, there's this issue of the Ingham County health plan and that millage. And that's something that we're going to watch at the federal level, because Michigan's law, when they passed the expansion of Medicaid, left a clause in there that if the federal subsidies were decreased, that they could eliminate that expansion of the Medicaid. So we could have a lot of people, probably around 15 to 16,000, that could be impacted if those subsidies go away and if the state decides to drop that expanded Medicaid. And we don't want to leave people out there without opportunities to receive good health care.
Do you think addressing those problems that you've just described will require new sources of revenue or reallocation of current resources?
You know, I spoke to a lot of the commissioners before the appointment. I really wanted to try and get a grasp of where we were at financially. And the budgets are tight. As you know, over the years, the last 10 to 12 years, revenue sharing has continued to be cut. So it really makes the county dependent upon property taxes, which have not raised much above inflation. That being said, there's challenges ahead. We've obviously got pension liabilities that we need to take care of. We don't want to put people's pensions or medical care when they're retired at risk. So we need to address that. But I do think there's opportunities, whether it's through proper asset management, or I recently read an article about in Texas how they saved $3 million from just recalibrating the salt spreaders on their trucks. Another one was West Virginia, where they saved $200,000 by unscrewing a light bulb in the Coke machine. Now, you know, little things like that add up. They're not the end all, but I do think we need to look at where we want to go and how we can get there in the most efficient manner. And sometimes we have to spend a little more to be more efficient. So I see that this is an overall plan, and there's a lot of good commissioners that are more familiar with the budget and more familiar with operations that I want to work with and learn to see how I might assist with new ideas and different thought processes.
Why did you want this job?
You know, I ran for this office in 2002. I did not win at that time. I've had great representation on the east side. Lost to a friend, Tina Weatherwax Grant, who did a great job. But I really feel like county government plays an umbrella role of helping people and providing services that fill in a lot of those gaps that aren't provided by local municipalities. It brings people together, and so to me, it was a logical role for me, wanting to work with people, wanting to help my community, and I saw it as a way to get involved with county government and make a difference in the community. I know it sounds kind of tagline, but that's really the truth.
Have you thought yet about whether you'll run for the seat in November?
I am going to run. I made that clear when I interviewed for the appointment process. I believe I can make a difference. I think I'm the best candidate that applied. There were some wonderful people that applied, and I know the commissioners who made the appointment had a hard process of the decision making, but I'm definitely going to run. I'm definitely excited. I'm trying to get out there right now and meet with key constituencies, and also to let people know a lot of I've been active in the neighborhood and people know me. I'm not sure they know I'm their county commissioner now, so I want to get out there and let them know if I can help them in any way, that's what I'm there to do.
Dennis Lowney is the newest member of the Ingham County Board of Commissioners. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott, and thanks for the service you do with WKAR. You provide a vital communication role that we're fortunate to have here in the East Side and Lansing area.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
Now let's head into nature. Every winter, outdoor enthusiasts gather on Black Lake, not far from Lake Huron, on a crusade to catch a fish in Michigan that dates back to prehistoric times. Our reporting partners at Great Lakes Today includes fellow NPR stations from across Michigan that look into environmental issues. Ben Thorpe takes us fishing.
Black Lake is about 6 miles long, and every February, anglers cut holes in the ice, wheel out shacks, and tie up spears. They're preparing to go after the lake sturgeon, a fish that some say is as old as the dinosaurs. It's ancient, a bottom feeder that meanders through the lake and can grow to more than 7 feet long and live to be 150 years old. Back in 1997, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources raised the alarm when sturgeon populations in the Great Lakes dipped from 1,600 to just over 500. Dave Borgeson is the Northern Lake Huron Unit Supervisor for the DNR. He oversees the lake sturgeon fishing season. He says strict quotas were put in place on how many sturgeon could be taken from the lake.
Back then it was five. We allowed five people on the ice.
That's five fish for the entire season, and only five people allowed on the ice to catch the fish.
It really got tedious. Sometimes the season lasted for a couple weeks.
Now it's 14 sturgeon for the entire season. That's seven for U.S. anglers and seven for members of the five local tribes. Also, an unlimited number of people are now allowed to fish for the sturgeon. This year, more than 400 people are registered to be the one to make the big catch. Borgeson says the restricted season seems to have worked. Lake sturgeon populations have reached about 1,200 fish. Anglers like Chad Mushlock from Sheboygan say the lake sturgeon season has become a tradition. He and a few friends were prepping their shack on an early Saturday morning, sometime between 6 and 7:30, a gray light just beginning to poke through the clouds.
We're going to try fishing in a group as the 30-footer with a lot of peeled eyes. We need them this morning. That's what brings us here.
Mushlock said he has a simple strategy for sturgeon fishing.
See one? Stick them.
As 8 o'clock rolls around, Mushlock and his friends climb into the shack, ready their spears, and turn out the lights. It will take a moment for their eyes to adjust. A soft light emanating up from the hole in the ice. Within the first 20 minutes, two sturgeon are called in over the radio.
They're on the ice. One came out of the state park down there.
Of course it did.
The shanty gets antsy. Someone puts on Steve Earle's Copperhead Road.
Come on, Steve Earle. Draw them in for me, buddy.
Across the lake, some are having more luck than Mushlock and his friends. Travis Merchant, a Sheboygan native, spears the fourth fish of the day, a 70-inch sturgeon weighing just under 100 pounds. It will be the biggest catch of the day. When I catch up with them, Mackenzie Durhammer, Merchant's girlfriend, gleefully recalls the moment they pulled the fish out of the lake.
I've never been out sturgeon fishing before, so it was like crazy. I was shaking like crazy, and it was exciting though. I'm excited for him.
The calls continue to come in, and at 10:23, the DNR calls the season at six fish in just under 2.5 hours. Borgeson says this was the highest participation the DNR has seen in a season.
Sturgeon, for whatever reason, once people see him or get involved with him, they love him. It's just a big, big lovable beast that folks gravitate to. And it's nice to see the interest.
With any luck, Borgeson says, that interest will help keep this prehistoric beast alive for generations to come. Reporting for Great Lakes Today, I'm Ben Thorpe.
And that brings today's current state to a close. We've posted links to the stories that you heard today on WKAR.org. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick, and for the entire WKAR News team, have a great weekend. We leave you now with music from Korean R&B boy band VIXX. which was part of the Winter Olympics opening ceremony.
Yeah, 넌 것만 같아.